Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few months, we have heard so many stories about businesses that cannot find employees. Republicans blame the problem on the federal government's $300 weekly supplement to unemployment benefits. Nearly half of all states, all led by Republican governors, have ended that supplement early. Low-wage workers were the biggest beneficiaries. Well, here's an important fact that deserves far more attention. And this is a fact that those Republican governors do not discuss. In late 2019, the Brookings Institution took a deep look at pay across the country and found that 53 million people, or 44% of workers in the U.S., earn low wages, just $10.22 an hour. That is 53 million people earning a median wage of $10.22 an hour. Those working full-time make just $24,000 a year. More than half are in their prime working years of 25 to 50 years old. This age group is also the most likely to be raising children. Nearly one-third live below 150% of the federal poverty line. That's about $36,000 for a family of four. UC Berkeley labor economist Sylvia Allegretto told the Los Angeles Times that there's simply no labor shortage when you're talking about finding house cleaners for a hotel. There's a shortage of workers who want to work at what you're offering. She said the country is experiencing a wage and benefit shortage. And that is the case with restaurants, according to a new One Fair Wage report called It's a Wage Shortage, Not a Worker Shortage. The report found that 76% of food service workers are considering leaving the industry because of low wages and tips. 78% of respondents said that they would stay if they had a full, stable, livable wage. So what is really going on with the economy right now? Well, joining us to talk about this are two guests. Saru Jayaraman is president of One Fair Wage, a nonprofit that advocates for ending the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Saru is also founder and director of the Food Research Center at UC Berkeley and has spent the last 20 years organizing and advocating for restaurant workers and service workers. Hi, Saru. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, thank you.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Ioana Marinescu, associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice and a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Dr. Marinescu's research expertise includes wage determination, universal basic income, unemployment insurance, and the minimum wage. Hi, Dr. Marinescu. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I want to ask you both about this really important report from Brookings that came out in 2019. Saru, why do you think we don't hear more about this, that so many people in this country, 53 million, make a median wage of just $10.22 an hour?
Unfortunately, it's even worse than that. I mean, as you said, I've been organizing restaurant workers for the last 20 years. The restaurant industry is the second largest and absolute fastest growing private sector employer in the United States. And the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the U.S., which are the majority of restaurant workers, is just $2.13 an hour. These workers are in most states, 43 out of 50 states, not in California, but in 43 states, forced to basically get tips from customers to make up their base wage. So, you know, it's $10, you know, median wage for 53 million Americans, but it's actually much less for the largest and fastest growing industries, which just means that number, that 53 million, is growing. It's not stagnant. It is actually the fastest growing part of our economy. And we don't talk about it because what dominates, you know, the public discourse, policy discourse, you know, on Capitol Hill, in Congress, even in Sacramento, what dominates is the needs and concerns of business. And especially during the pandemic, we saw in our industry, for example, you know, yes, thousands of small business restaurants shut down, struggling, and millions of low-wage workers losing their homes, unable to feed their children, and so much more emphasis put on you know, small business restaurants losing their business, maybe losing some of their savings, close, you know, having to shut down something that they created, all of which is sad and we should definitely worry about. But the scale of destitution and the kind of suffering that low-wage workers experienced over this last year was life-threatening for themselves and their families. The health risks went way up, tips went way down. And so, you know, what I find particularly cruel is that for so many decades, both these business owners, some of these businesses, not all of them, but some of these business owners, particularly the trade lobbies, and so many people in Congress, and so many people have been telling these workers, if you don't like it, leave. Mm. And guess what the workers have done over the last year? They have said, okay, we're leaving. It doesn't add up anymore. The health risks and the hostility and the harassment is too high. The wages are too low. We are leaving. And in response, they are called lazy. They are told, oh, you're staying home collecting unemployment insurance, when the majority of workers we surveyed never got unemployment insurance because they were told their wages were too low to qualify for benefits. So we have a problem in this country where the largest and fastest growing sectors are the lowest paying. And we are not paying enough attention to it because we are so focused on what's happening to business and not what's happening to the millions of people who, frankly, make those businesses go. Like there's no the consumption power of this country is dramatically decreased and will continue to be so unless we address the wage shortage.
Dr. Marinescu, what would you add?
Well, what I'd like to add is that, you know, we have to understand the market conditions that lead to this situation. And I think we economists have been concerned about low wages for a while. However, there are limits to what can be done if we think that these low wages are merely the result of market forces, that these people just don't have enough skills, they don't have enough marketable skills, and that's just what their labor is worth to employers. And some of the things that have been changing in our thinking, and that's partly prompted by my own work, is the understanding of what we call monopsony power, namely that in many cases, workers don't have many other alternatives to leave. You know, as Sarah just said, they're told, well, if you don't like it, just leave. Yes. However, many workers, for example, due to transportation problems, can only access a few jobs, and there are only a few employers oftentimes who dominate the industry. And so that makes it so that they cannot be paid at what they're truly worth to their employers, and instead they're underpaid in many cases relative to their productivity. And I think what's happening now is that there is an increase in workers' bargaining power that stems from the growth in labor demand, in particular in the restaurant industry, with more and more people wanting to consume at restaurants, and therefore workers are in high end demand, and that puts them in a better position to try to get better wages and working conditions. And that also includes going potentially in other industries that are also growing at the moment. So I think it's important to think about what are some of the factors that are driving all of this.
You also, in past interviews, you say that it's important to emphasize that wages for low workers have barely increased since the 1980s. Economic growth in many industries has exploded, but it's gone to the top. And in part, that is due to wage stagnation.
That's absolutely right. So if you look at the growth of wages on average, you know, wages have sort of kept up with growth, but that's average, which includes the wages of the very, very high paid. And most of the growth in wages that we've seen at all since 1980 went to the very, very top of the wage distribution, to, you know, executives and, you know, other workers who are making very high wages, and very little, if any at all, has gone to low paid workers. And so there's growing inequality. And, you know, we don't fully understand what the reasons are, but certainly, you know, that comes from a variety of causes that have eroded worker power, such as the decline of unions, or on the other end, preferential tax treatment that is given to corporations and high-income workers that make it, you know, more profitable to pay these people more relative to, you know, the regular worker.
Saru, how do you think the frame should be changed or can be changed around this. Because according to University of Chicago economist Peter Ganong, 4 in 10 jobless workers would get more money from their benefits than a paycheck when you factor in an extra $300 a week. Now that should be the story. Is why is it that so many people are bringing more money home from a $300 a week paycheck than if they were working full time? But what happened, I heard Republican after Republican on, you know, various stations go on and say people are staying home because of this. They don't want to go back to work, rather than, well, what the problem here is the wages. So how do you change the frame?
Yeah, it's a great question. And as I mentioned, there's when I hear that from Republicans and frankly from some Democrats as well, you know, it is gut-wrenching because, as I mentioned, you know, we started a relief fund last year, 250,000 restaurant workers who were displaced as a result of the pandemic applied for relief. 63%, nearly two-thirds, said that either they couldn't get unemployment insurance or they had great difficulty accessing unemployment insurance because their tips were not counted towards their wage when the government did a calculation of how much they had earned. And because of that, they were viewed as just having earned this sub-minimum wage, which is the case in most states. And they were told that their wages were too low to qualify for benefits. So in most states, a lot of these workers were marked as a denial by the state. And then when they applied for the federal unemployment insurance, which came through the state system, they were told you're eligible, but were not able to access the funds because they had been marked as a denial through their state. So I cannot tell you the number of workers who never got unemployment insurance last year. Millions and millions of workers who didn't get it or who got way too little and ended up feeling forced to go back to work last summer when restaurants were trying to do outdoor dining in the middle of the pandemic, and workers found tips went way down and hostility and harassment went way up. And that's when so many millions of workers left. So millions of workers left the industry last year. And what's happening now is not that people are leaving, it's that they've already left and restaurants are trying to reopen understaffed. And the workers who remain are saying, you don't pay me enough to do the work of 2 and 3 people. I'm leaving. And so the walkouts that are happening now are among workers who remain when millions of workers have already left. And so our reframing is to say, number one, most of these workers never got unemployment insurance to begin with. Again, number two, you told these workers, if you don't like it, leave, which is what they have done. And three, you know, let's look at what so many thousands of independent restaurant owners are doing now. So many thousands of independent restaurant owners across the country, including in California, are independently and voluntarily raising their wages because they have no choice but to do that in order to get workers to come back. And those independent restaurant owners, many of them are joining us and telling Congress members and policymakers, we have to raise wages across the board for two reasons. We can't do it alone as independent restaurant owners. We need it to be a level playing field so that Denny's and IHOP and McDonald's raise their wages alongside us, not just the independent restaurant owners. But two, they're saying, we can't do it alone because even when we raise our wages, we still are not getting a lot of applicants. Why? Why? It's because so many millions of workers left, you know, changed their lives, said this is not worth it anymore. I heard Dr. Marinescu say workers don't have a lot of options. That is true. But I've got to tell you, a lot of workers take great pride in working in the hospitality sector. Mm-hmm. They've done it for their lifetimes. They consider it a profession. It is a skilled profession. To Dr. Marinescu's part, the only reason we think of these as quote unquote low-skilled jobs is not that they are low-skilled. It is that they are low-paid and we treat them like low-skilled jobs. They are skilled professions. In other countries in Europe, you go to school for many years to be a hospitality professional. So these workers take great pride in their work. But last year, when things got so bad and state governments told them you earn too little to get benefits, it was like a light bulb went off. And they said, if I'm being told I get paid too little to earn benefits, probably I get paid too little. It's time for me to leave. And they did. Mm-hmm. And so we reframed this by saying, one, it's a wage shortage, not a worker shortage. Two, these workers never got unemployment insurance. Three, if independent restaurant owners are saying we can do this, we have to do this, and joining with workers to say it's time, then obviously it's time. It's time not just for the workers. It's time for employers who desperately want these workers to come back. It's time for all of us who want to enjoy the restaurant industry we had prior to the pandemic, which we absolutely will not be able to enjoy unless we raise the wage.
Saru Jayaraman is president of One Fair Wage, a nonprofit that advocates for ending the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Dr. Ioana Marinescu is associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. And today we are talking about what's really happening with the economy here. One Fair Wage is out with a report called It's a Wage Shortage, Not a Worker Shortage. If you have any questions or comments on this issue, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Dr. Marinescu, to Saru's point about working conditions, there's a couple examples that I think spells it out. I'm just reading from ABC7 in Lincoln, Nebraska. A photo has gone viral on social media of a Burger King in Lincoln, Nebraska. The sign outside of the restaurant reads, "We all quit and sorry for the inconvenience." General Manager Rachel Flores said that the Burger King had employees working in the kitchen with no air conditioning for weeks. At one point, the kitchen surpassed 90 degrees. Flores ended up in the hospital for dehydration, and she said her boss said she was just being a baby. Now, when I read the Twitter thread about this, so many people in the restaurant industry said, excuse me, it's not just Burger King. It's so rare to have air conditioning. We are constantly overheating in our restaurants. People just do not understand how difficult this work really is.
Right. So, you know, one way to think about this is that working conditions are to be taken together in a bundle with wages. And what you observe in the economy typically is that worse working conditions go hand in hand with low wages. And that's part of what my research has shown. So, you know, many people think that if you're going to work in bad working conditions, you're going to get paid more in order to incite you to work in those conditions. But in reality, what's happening is that bad jobs, quote unquote, are bad both in terms of paying low wages as well as having, you know, difficult working conditions. And, you know, to follow up on Saru's point about unemployment insurance, you know, the picture is just much more complicated, which is that applications, you know, the number of job applications does decline when the generosity of unemployment insurance goes up. And that makes a lot of sense because people have more opportunities to look for a job that they really want and precisely avoid these kinds of working conditions. But at the same time, this effect is probably not very large because the main thing that's going on, as I already said, is that, and Saru also mentioned, is that everybody wants to hire at the same time. There's a big rebound in demand for restaurants. And we have to ask, where is this demand for restaurants coming from? To a large extent, it's because of government intervention, the benefits, the stimulus checks that have allowed Americans to have an income that they can still rely on despite the pandemic and be able now, finally, that the virus is more under control. Now they're able to use their income to go out and dine. And so we have to see the other side of the coin as well, which is that, well, on the one hand, these benefits might make it a little bit harder for employers to hire because they have to offer better jobs. On the other hand, the reason why they want to hire so many workers is because there's high demand, and this high demand itself is partly prompted by the benefits and the stimulus checks and all the action that the government has had to address the pandemic.
Saru, there's a big action happening on July 20th. Fast food and restaurant workers are planning actions across the country on the anniversary of the last time the federal minimum wage was increased. $7.25 it is right now. It was last raised in 2009. Business Insider is reporting on this. And Martha Asorto, a McDonald's worker in Houston, says 12 years without a raise in the minimum wage is way too long. I'm going on strike because I can't afford to wait any longer for $15 an hour.
Yeah, 12 years is close to a generation now. Or it's only half a generation. Now think about restaurant workers. The tip minimum wage has not gone up in 31 years. It's been frozen at $2.13 an hour at the federal level since 1991. We know actually two generations of women, mothers and daughters, because this is tipped workers are over two thirds women, mostly women working in very casual restaurants across the country, struggling to make ends meet, struggling with very high rates of sexual harassment because they have to put up with all kinds of customer behavior to feed their families and tips. So 12 years for most workers, or, you know, I would say half of minimum wage workers, and then 31 years for all these other workers, for a good 14 million workers in the restaurant industry. It is outrageous. And again, to Dr. Marinescu's point, this is not organic. It didn't just happen. This is because of the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association. We call it the other NRA. It has been around over 100 years lobbying the CRA in California. California Restaurant Association is the chapter of the NRA. The other NRA, as we call it, has lobbied since emancipation of slavery to keep these wages basically non-existent, to keep them at $0 initially, and now $2 at the federal level, $7 for non-tipped workers. And it is the National Restaurant Association that is blocking even Democrats who say, you know, yes, I would support 15, but how can I do it when the NRA tells me not to? And this is the fundamental problem we're facing right now. It is not a worker shortage. It is not, it's really not anything else except the political power of trade lobbies in Congress and in state legislatures that represent multi-billion dollar corporations and that have managed to, you know, assert that they shouldn't have to pay their own workers, that somebody else, namely customers, should pay their workers' wages through tips. And that is the primary battle we need to have. We need to let legislators know that ultimately they're accountable to people and to workers who, frankly, are more voters than the restaurant owners, than the chain restaurants. Workers are the ones that they're accountable to people, customers who want to see restaurants reopen. They're accountable to us, not to these trade lobbies that will keep these wages as low as possible for as long as possible if they could.
Dr. Marinescu, can you talk as an economist about, you know, how you think about the major differences between a massive chain like a McDonald's, where the CEO, Chris Kempczinski, makes a $10.8 million, according to NRN.com, and then a small mom and pop restaurant on the corner. I mean, we just got a call from a restaurant owner who says, we have to raise prices to accommodate workers and customers. We are suffering too. So how do you think about this? I mean, a massive corporation like McDonald's, it's really shocking that they're still not paying a minimum, a higher wage, a livable wage, I should say. But then you've got the small restaurant that is maybe trying to do what they can to treat their workers right, and yet they have no profit margin like McDonald's does.
Right. So typically, large corporations across the economy tend to be more profitable, more productive than small corporations. Not always. That's why we have, you know, some small corporations become big. But in general, that's the case. Just as you said, they tend to have lower profit margins. And that means that it can be more difficult for the small restaurants to increase wages than for, you know, the big chains. And in fact, you know, McDonald's just announced, you know, some voluntary increase in wages, which, by the way, speaks to the market conditions that right now they are experiencing difficulties in hiring and they want to pay people more so that they can get more people. So fundamentally, you know, getting back to the minimum wage is very important, you know, to set a minimum for workers. And, you know, the big concern usually is that a higher minimum wage will make workers too expensive and therefore will reduce the number of available jobs. And that is true. You know, if you make the minimum wage like really, really high, that is a risk. However, as I was arguing earlier, workers are typically underpaid because they lack other options, you know, where they could go elsewhere and say, well, if you underpay me, I'm just going to get up and leave. That's not the case that most workers can do that easily. As a result, most workers are underpaid, and that means that there is an opportunity to increase the minimum wage without cutting jobs because, again, since workers are underpaid, we have the opportunity to increase their wages somewhat and without being worried about losses in employment. So in that sense, I very much support an increase in the federal minimum wage, because again, most workers are underpaid, and increasing the wage, in fact, not only will not cut employment, but potentially in some cases could increase employment, just like Saru was saying, by making the job more attractive. That's the whole point, you know, of paying more. That will just make certain jobs more attractive, and therefore potentially, in some cases, increase employment.
What are your thoughts on this, Saru? Because the Fight for 15 has been happening for a long time. It's an incredible movement. But when you think about it, someone making $15 an hour would make just over $31,000 a year. It's really hard to live on $31,000 a year, especially if you're raising a family.
Absolutely. But it is such an important first step to get this country from wages of $2 and $7 to $15. It would make a tremendous difference, particularly for workers in states that have been left behind all over the South and the Midwest. You know, workers are still struggling with these absurd, you know, literal legacy of slavery wages of $2 and $7. So it would be a huge step forward to move to 15, to end the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, which has just been a, frankly, a pox on this country for 150 years since emancipation. And as a first step, that will then be indexed. The Raise the Wage Act, which is moving through Congress, calls for a $15 minimum wage that is then indexed with what they call average wage growth. That's what the bill that's in moving through Congress proposes. So you're absolutely right. We need more, but it would be a tremendous first step to achieve what we have in California, which is $15 and a full minimum wage for workers with tips on top. And just to speak to your small business question, I think it's important for people in California to know that we actually have the highest small business restaurant growth rates of any state in the US. We have the highest overall restaurant industry job growth rates of any state in the US. And you don't have to listen to me. The Denny's CFO was caught red-handed in February when Denny's and the other NRA were telling Congress, there's no way we could afford paying 15. There's no way we could afford paying tipped workers anything more than $2. We'll go out of business. In that same moment, the CFO of Denny's was telling shareholders on an analyst call, in fact, Denny's has grown faster in California than any other state in the U.S. because minimum wage is higher, tipped workers get a full minimum wage, and therefore customer spending is higher. Guest receipts are higher, the number of customers we get is higher. And that is true across the board. It's something we've been saying for a long time, and now we've caught these companies, you know, admitting it, which is that when you pay these workers more, especially restaurant workers, they guess what they do? They spend it. They eat out. As everybody knows, low-wage workers will spend a higher percentage of their income than higher wage workers because they have to for survival. And so they go out, they spend it, they eat out, they tend to tip better than other people. And so wages are higher, guest receipts are higher, customer spending is higher, tips are higher, small business growth rates are higher. And ultimately, small businesses do rely on Main Street, on the people to spend to be able to survive. And that is why so many small businesses across the country have joined us in calling to pass the Raise the Wage Act.
Two quick questions before we let you go, Saru. I wanted to ask you about tips. One thing I've noticed since restaurants have opened again is you order by Q code. So basically you put your phone over the QR code, you order, and then someone brings you the food and you leave a tip on your phone. And I just wonder, how are those tips dispersed? Because I'm seeing more and more of these QR codes.
Yeah. So always in a restaurant, tips are dispersed among all the service, are shared among service workers. So when you tip your server, it doesn't just go to the server, it is shared with the bartender, with barbacks, bussers, other tipped workers. In California and other states where everybody gets a full minimum wage, tips can also be shared with back of house workers, with kitchen staff. So tips are shared. And I think during the pandemic, we saw with the QR codes, even more sharing of these tips among all workers in the restaurant, because everybody really had to come together to do things a little bit differently. And so that, I think, there's a lot of good things that could happen for our industry coming out of the pandemic. Wages could definitely go up. They are, in fact, going up, not by policy, but by voluntary companies voluntarily raising their wages. We can see restaurants implementing more equity, especially after the murder of George Floyd. We were approached by thousands of restaurant owners across the country wanting to move away from a legacy of slavery, wanting to increase race and gender equity in restaurants. And I think things like the QR codes and other kind of changes in the way people are ordering and tipping have also resulted in workers having to come together, creating more unity across different kinds of workers. So I think there could be positive changes, but not if we don't prioritize bringing these workers back. And that means permanent wage change. I just want to close by saying one thing. What a lot of the small business owners are telling us is that I'm raising my wages, but it's still hard to get workers to come back. Well, I can tell you why. So many workers who've changed their lives, disrupted their lives to leave the industry are saying, I can't flip back for something that I don't know is a permanent guarantee of increased wages. How do I know that this one small business employer is going to stick with the higher wage after the economy settles down or really post pandemic? You know, I don't need a signing bonus. What I need is a permanent livable wage. And only government can send the signal to millions of workers who've left. We are now going to see permanent wage change. Mm-hmm. That is what small businesses are asking policymakers to do, is to send the signal to millions of workers that there will be permanent wage change. It is worth coming back to work in restaurants so that we all can enjoy the industry we enjoyed prior to the pandemic.
And Dr. Marinescu, final thoughts. Where do you see this going as so many people are saying, I'm tired of not being able to make ends meet? And so many people are trying to unionize. They're going on strike. Where do you see these movements going?
So I think right now we are experiencing an improved bargaining position for labor in general because of the employers all trying to hire at the same time. And that can mean that workers not only will be able to command higher wages, and that's already the case, as Saru mentioned, in the restaurant industry, but also potentially a higher opportunity for unionization, since it's typically easier to unionize when market conditions are strong and favor workers, that typically makes unionization more likely. Of course, the future will also depend on government regulations and, for example, the degree to which, you know, they will support unionization by making it more difficult for employers to, for example, interfere with union campaigns. So, you know, this is a transitionary phase, as Saru was saying, and, you know, the future is probably going to look a little bit better for workers, but this may not be durable, depending on both where the economy is going, how long will this strong growth last, and probably can't last forever, so it's going to settle down. And two, what's government policy as far as, in particular, the minimum wage, but also unions, with both of those aspects being important determinants of wages in the economy.
Dr. Ioana Marinescu is Associate Professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy. Saru Jayaraman is President of One Fair Wage. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can find more information about the One Fair Wage study that says it's a wage shortage, not a worker shortage, at yourcallradio.org. After the break, we'll talk about how the pandemic has pushed working moms out of the labor force. Many have not returned to work because they have taken on major childcare responsibilities. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation. On Your Call, you can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to yourcall@klw.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, you may call toll-free to 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. What's Congress going to do before they all go on summer vacation? That'll be the topic on 1A just a half an hour from now, 20 minutes from now, here on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about this year's annual Labor Fest, which is running through the end of the month. There's so many events happening. There's panels, including Amazon workers who are standing up to union busting efforts, gig workers who are fighting for basic rights, and frontline healthcare workers who are still demanding basic safety protections against COVID. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow. Right now, we're going to talk about working moms. During the pandemic, so many working moms had no choice but to leave the workforce. With schools or daycare centers closed, many moms had to take on childcare, virtual learning, and other responsibilities at home. Many moms are also taking care of parents, which makes it even more difficult to juggle it all. Joining us to talk about this is Christine Beckman, professor of public policy at the University of Southern California, where she's the Price Family Chair in Social Innovation. In an interview with Cal Matters, Professor Beckman said she hoped COVID would shine a light on the gender imbalance of childcare in the home, but she says it didn't. She says the data shows that women are still working twice as much as men were working at home. Hi, Professor Beckman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, great to have you. And, you know, in that interview, you said that if the pandemic did not cause us to rethink those gender roles and gender expectations for housework, I'm not sure what will. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, a colleague of mine, Melissa Masmanian, we wrote a book that came out like 3 months into the pandemic, and we were writing about the division of labor at home, and we were writing about the support structures that working families needed to, you know, keep their families together so that people could work. And we thought, wow, okay, you know, all of the things that we've talked about are now like just visible, right? People's support structures fell away. People are having to figure, they don't have anybody to rely on other than the people in their home. This is the moment where, you know, men and women are going to share better the responsibilities at home, because there's absolutely no one else you could call on, right? Especially in those early days, it was just the people within the four walls of where you were living. And we didn't see that happen. And I know, honestly, I was shocked. I thought maybe a silver lining of this pandemic will be that we'll sort of see how much work and how much time and how much effort mothers are putting into taking care of their families and their households, as well as working and holding down full-time jobs. And so, right, I mean, like, as I said, if this didn't do it, I don't want to be overly pessimistic, but it was a really hard thing to see. If this didn't do it, right, what will?
What do you think explains that?
Oh, it's so many things. So, you know, I mean, those gender roles are sticky, and both men and women subscribe to them. I think another thing, though, is that a lot of the work of maintaining a household is not easy to see. It's called invisible work for a reason, and it's because, you know, you don't see all of the effort of coordinating the schedules, the making the mental lists of not only what are we going to have for dinner, but what do we need at the grocery store, doctor's appointments, dentist appointments, you know, all of those arrangements and those lists that are often made by moms. And so even when partners are helping out, it tends to be with the physical work. And that is where we've seen more gains, you know, the doing of the dishes, the laundry, even child, you know, actual child care responsibilities, that stuff is easier to see. And so in some sense, it's easier to reshuffle and share, but the mental work and the coordinating work and the emotional work of sort of tracking everything that has really, resided with women. I mean, historically, and continuing on in the pandemic, right? It's hard to share what you can't see.
Right. And this has been so difficult for moms across the board, but especially difficult for single moms making low wages. As we talked about in our last segment, almost half of workers in this country make about $24,000 a year or less. So imagine a single mom making that salary and then having to balance all of these things with the virtual schooling, the childcare. Many moms, as I said, are taking care of parents, and I'd love to talk with you about that later in the show. There's just no way that you can balance all of that.
No, there really isn't. And you know, the way, you know, we have a poor infrastructure in the U.S. for supporting working parents. And so the way that people have managed is through schools, right? Through childcare, if you're lucky enough to be able to afford it, and through neighbors and family members, right? Extended family that really could, people have cobbled it together, right? And started to make it work. And the pandemic just took that away in an instant. You know, lots of people that were relying on grandparents, those people didn't feel safe in the beginning coming into homes. And so, I mean, it was devastatingly difficult before the pandemic, and just to see the toll it's taken on people and how exhausted they are has just been, you know, it's heartbreaking to see and maddening that we don't have a better solution than for individuals to figure it out on their own.
There's so many studies, so many articles have been written about this. In the Cal Matters piece you were quoted in, we meet Patricia Gutierrez. Before the pandemic, she would drop off her 8-year-old autistic son at a school in San Jose and her 4-year-old son at a daycare every morning. After her mom, who suffers from Alzheimer's, was picked up and shuttled to a senior center, Patricia Gutierrez would drive to work as a licensed vocational nurse at a school for special needs students. But as COVID cases began to spread in California, her son's school, the senior center and the daycare all closed. She lost her job and then signed up for unemployment. And then she had 2 kids and a declining mother at home. There's so many people who went through similar struggles.
Absolutely. I mean, a third of households have children and a quarter of households are caring for elderly family members. And so that's a lot of households in really dire straits.
Why do you think that we don't talk more about women who are taking care of their parents? I mean, I come from a generation where a lot of our parents got divorced. And a lot of us have maybe one parent who, probably a dad, who has a pension and healthcare and is doing all right. But we have a mom who doesn't have that. And so it's on us to take care of the mom. Why don't we talk more about that in this society?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have a great answer for it. You know, I think, kids do get the dominant amount of the conversation. And and I think to go back to the point you made earlier around sort of the lower income and people of color, right? And so it's also important to note, like the person in the article, Patricia, that was written about, it's often taking care of sicker people, right, than people at higher income. So not only do they have less resources to manage, but because of the systemic issues in our healthcare system, right, those people are taking care of family members that are less well. And so it's even more difficult as a result of that.
We're speaking with Christine Beckman, professor of public policy at the University of Southern California, where she is the Price Family Chair in Social Innovation. Christine is co-author of Dreams of the Overworked, Living, Working, and Parenting in the Digital Age. Christine, childcare is something that is getting so much more attention, given that the United States is one of the, well, here's an article from UNICEF. Affordable quality childcare is inaccessible in the United States. What is it going to take to ensure that childcare is available, especially for low income families, but really all families, because families get really hit hard when it comes to childcare?
They sure do. And as you said, childcare is enormously expensive. I mean, in California, it costs more to have an infant in childcare than it would send to a college age kid to public college. You know, it's taking, it's more than your average rent for taking care of an infant. We're ranked, third for like most expensive childcare in the country. So it's unaffordable for typical families, much less low income families, right? You know, 25, 30% of your income going to childcare. It's just really not doable. I think the American Rescue Plan, where we have the child care credit, was really a remarkable step forward, right? It's only temporary, right? We're still to see whether or not that gets made permanent. But that sort of was a way of providing a monthly sort of stipend to people that did have young kids to help them pay for childcare. And the nice thing about that is the flexibility of it, right? So maybe it's a formal childcare center, maybe it's neighbors or family members, right? Because there's not enough childcare slots, right? We also lost a lot of childcare slots during the pandemic. Those slots have not come back. That industry has not returned. They're still at 70% employment in childcare. So even if you had the wherewithal to pay for childcare, not everyone can even get it. So I think the flexibility of being able to use that in different ways is useful in this moment.
What do you think of the Biden plan? They're going to spend $225 billion to improve childcare. The funding would help providers improve the quality of programs. $425 billion would go toward establishing universal preschool for 3 and 4-year-olds.
I think it's all essential, right? As we've been talking about, this is the infrastructure that allows people to work, and it's not and working is what you need to do to put food on the table, right? These are not discretionary jobs; these are breadwinners in families, and without that support, it's incredibly difficult. So universal pre-K is terrific, and if you imagine, right, even the 0 to 5 is the most difficult and most expensive time to have kids. We don't have as many places for the kids to be watched, and it's more expensive to pay for. So the universal pre-K helps in the sense that it gets the kids into the formal schooling system earlier. We want high quality childcare. We want childcare providers that are paid living wages. So all of that investment helps on all of those fronts. It doesn't get us all the way there though, because, you know, school ends at 3:30 for an elementary or a junior high school. And I'm always struck by the assumption for families where people are working, until 5, sometimes much longer, but the system assumes that we have someone to watch our kids while we're at work, even when we have, a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old.
Well, one of the things that came up in so many of the articles about working moms who've left the workforce is flexibility. And a lot of moms who maybe work in tech or a similar kind of job have been able to get another job where they can work from home. And it's really helpful, although it's still really difficult, especially with virtual learning. But if you're a low-wage worker working in the service industry, and according to Brookings, 43% of low-wage workers have children, there's no such thing as flexible work. In some cases, you don't know your schedule until maybe the Friday before the week.
Yeah, that dynamic scheduling where you can't even plan when you need childcare until the week before is incredibly disruptive to families. You know, it's associated with, as you can imagine, psychological stress and negative mental health, because that's just a lot to be worried about on a weekly basis. Where are my kids going to be where I can work? But because you're right, I mean, it's the jobs where women tend to be employed, those are industries that were hit disproportionately in the pandemic. And as they're recovering, they're recovering, but the schools are still closed. We still don't have the childcare facilities. So it's been incredibly difficult. And then of course, essential workers are disproportionately women as well. So, on the front lines, low wage, and with that caregiving responsibility for kids and elderly, really, I feel like I keep saying the same thing over and over, right? It's impossible. We're putting these people in impossible situations.
So Christine, I mean, if we could think big here, I mean, we don't have to think that big because it's already happening in other countries. For example, in Denmark, people at McDonald's make $22 an hour. The New York Times had a piece about this back in May of 2020. NPR had a piece about preschool and daycare being free in Finland because people actually pay taxes to fund these programs. The child poverty rate is 25% in the United States, 5 times more than Finland. So what can we learn from other countries where programs are actually working and working mothers especially are not struggling so much like they are here in the United States?
Well, I mean, it is this infrastructure that you know, the Biden and Harris plan sort of talks about. It's really recognizing that, that human infrastructure is part of what we rely on to make our society operate. And we've operated for such a long time with it being unpaid and devalued. And if you note, there's plenty of examples where it does work. And it's not rocket science. It's about investing in those systems and in those support structures to make it work. And this, I think, is the hopeful part of coming out of the pandemic, that even though I'm not as optimistic about the gender roles, it does feel like as a society, we were recognizing how important the teachers, the childcare providers are to making our lives work.
Right. I mean, that's the one thing I think that we've been, you know, before the pandemic, it was Fortune magazine covers with tech execs constantly. And then all of a sudden it switched and it was the healthcare workers, the people who actually, you know, people like you said, restaurant workers, teachers, social workers. Do you think that has really shifted? Will that last?
I sure hope so. You know, it's so easy in so many ways to just want to get back to the way things were. But things weren't great for those folks before. We need, you know, I don't know, that, you know, the virtual schooling, the having to cook and clean, the people of means, right, that had to rely on themselves to do things. Yeah, you hope that having done virtual school, you are much more appreciative of your teachers for your children, and that lasts with some time. But if we don't turn to real, you know, solutions and infrastructure and changing the system, we will forget, and we'll go back to lionizing the, you know, the billionaires and the tech workers and forget. So I think it's a really a moment where we need to take advantage of the awareness that we have and use it to make real policy changes.
Christine Beckman is professor of public policy at the University of Southern California, where she's the Price Family Chair in Social Innovation and co-author of Dreams of the Overworked, Living, Working, and Parenting in the Digital Age. Professor Beckman, thanks so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You can find more information about working moms and what they are facing during the pandemic at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we've got a related show. We're going to talk about the 28th Annual Labor Fest, which is running through the end of the month. There's so many events, films, tours, panels, Amazon workers who are standing up to union busting efforts, gig workers who are fighting for their rights, and frontline healthcare workers who are still demanding basic safety protections against COVID. The majority of the events are free. We hope you can join us tomorrow. Thanks to Leah Sesmer for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find more information, sign up for our podcast, share our show with your friends at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
This is KALW's 80th year broadcasting for the San Francisco Bay Area. During that time, we've told a lot of stories.
And what we were fighting for became harder and harder to see. And what the park became was farther and farther from the original vision.
We're looking forward to telling a whole lot more. Thanks for listening to and supporting KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.